Blog Talk Radio.
For breaking news.
Good evening. This is EAL Radio coming live to you with this breaking news. United Airlines and competitors seriously rethink denied boarding policies and payouts by Louis Lazar. United Airlines made headlines around the world today for increasing its denied boarding compensation ceiling to $10,000. That's a whopping 10 times the $1,000 ceiling that existed prior to the United Express Flight 3411 incident, during which United employees could not coax enough passengers off the plane with the money the carrier was offering them. United States-based airlines, including United, are rushing to rethink denied Seymour and Newsline letter on line 217. Linda?
Gia Rappaport. Wright Electric, a San Luis Obispo-based startup, aims to make every short commercial flight electric within 20 years by building what co-founder Jeff Engler calls their Electric 737. Wright's vision is a 150-seat short-haul aircraft capable of serving routes under 300 miles. Engler told attendees at the Sustainable Aviation Symposium that Wright was inspired to reject energy density arguments by looking at data on the length of commercial flights around the world. See more in newsletter online 2017.
Breaking news. Fresno hopes to train in electric aircraft. This article is by Jeff Rappaport. Subsidized by local funds from Fresno County, a fleet of four Piperstill aircraft electro trainers will be made available for primary training in California's Central Valley later on this year, program organizers hope. Fresno County will be installing chargers for the aircraft at four local airports: Mendota, Redley, Fresno Chandler, and the fourth airport to be determined. The Alpha Electro has magnum endurance of approximately 90 miles and an 85-knot cruising speed, making a round-trip cross-country stretch of flights a bit of a stretch. See more in newsletter online on 2017. Chuck.
Breaking news. JetBlue asked for more routes to Cuba after Spirit and Frontier dropped out. This was by Edmund Reiser. JetBlue Airways Corp. last week filed an application to add more flights between Fort Lauderdale and Havana and to launch what was said to be the first ever nonstop service between Boston and Cuba's capital city. The New York-based airline with a NASDAQ of JBLU is asking for more Cuban routes after Spirit and Frontier Airlines announced they will end their commercial trip between the island nation and South Florida. Silver Airways, based in Fort Lauderdale, will also end its flight to Cuba, saying the market was too crowded and not profitable. See more on newsletter out online 2017. Hello, Eastern family. It's time for the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We are heard for many areas around the U.S. and listens to over 40 countries around the world. We're adding news items as breaking news at the beginning of our show. Let us know your thoughts about this small change in our broadcast format. My name is Chuck Albright. I'm sitting in for Jim Hart tonight. Along with our other hosts, we're glad you're with us. The show is for you and about you and the Eastern family and the Eastern Airlines. Neil calls it Kitchen Table Radio. Just a reminder about how to go about signing into the show and calling in if you have any comments or you want to join the host. Here's all you need to do. Go to www.ealradioshow.com and look for the radio icon on the home page. Click on the arrow in the circle at 7 p.m. and you can listen on your computer. You can also tune in by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. This is the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio. Now, here's an easier way. Just call 213-816-1611 at 7 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, and you can listen right in on your phone. You can also join in the conversation by just saying hi, since you're already on the phone, and we want to hear from you. Neil, how about getting this episode in the air with a new Eastern airplane?
Well, we'll listen to a Eastern commercial briefly, and then we'll start up a Curtis Condor engine. Clear prop.
Trip has been booked with all 18 seats filled. This should be a great day for our trip to Atlanta. Mr. Kern, it is nice to have you come along with us on the inaugural flight of the newest airplane in our fleet.
Well, Pilot Brown, I feel certainly our passengers will enjoy the Curtis Condor, and it will add to the expansion of Eastern air transport into larger markets. You know, we are in need of qualified pilots. As put out, we put out the word among your pilot friends, if you would, to come in and see me here in Newark for an interview. Just ask for Station Operations Manager A.P. Kerr. We sure would appreciate it.
Yes, sir. I have a few in mind, and we'll send them in to see you. I understand we have 5 more aircraft that will be delivered soon. The 18 seats sure added to the profit for the company. This model B-20 has 4 more seats than the smaller Condor, and the T-32, and the 2 Curtis Conquistador 1,200 horsepower engines make it a dependable bird.
Pilot Brown, all of our passengers are comfortable seated and their luggage stored. We're ready in the back.
Thanks, Ms. Unwin. You can close the door now, and we'll start the engine and be on our way.
We've got the engine running, so we're going to let you guys taxi out and take off. And here's what you guys will sound like. Sounds more like a B-29 to me.
Yep.
Thanks. Thanks, Chuck. What a lineup we have for you guys tonight. Never before have we had on the radio show the aviation knowledge we have for you tonight. We've put together a roundtable panel for a discussion of a very important topic, as you heard Director A.P. Kerr in Newark suggest to Pilot Gene Brown, who was the very first Eastern Airlines pilot, put out the word for pilots even back in those days. So the coming pilot shortage is the subject of our discussion tonight. And Dorothy, we've got some guests. Carlene has checked in. She's with us in area code 206. Carlene, you with us?
I am with you. I had to unmute my phone.
Okay, very good. So got us worried there for a minute. But I'm going to let Dorothy introduce our guest from Embry-Riddle. Dorothy?
Yes, Dr. Wiggins is professor and chair of the Aeronautical Science Department at Embry-Riddle's Daytona Beach campus and has an impressive background. He has an ED.D. as a Doctor of Education in Applied Educational Studies. Though he was not a panelist in the Lift Off the Page live stream event, he is very familiar with the pilot shortage topic and was instrumental in the development of the story. A background for the Lift print publication. He can also discuss Embry-Riddle's National Training Aircraft Symposium and the past pilot, the Supply and Demand Summits, and how these events have played a role in waking up the airlines to the growing pilot supply deficit and related issues. We also have as our guest Colleen Pettit, who is doctor as well. She is author of several books, Flight to Safety, and many others, and we encourage you to check her website to be able to see the numbers she has. George Jen, of course, is a captain and former Eastern pilot, and he is on one of our regular hosts, as well as the author of, I'm sorry, George, it just slipped my mind.
George, maybe you can help her out.
Sorry about that.
Flying too close to the sun. George, I just opened your microphone. I'm sorry. Would you repeat that again?
Destination Final Disaster.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. My mind just left me. So we have a great deal of people that are going to be with us tonight calling in, and we look forward to any questions you may have. Neil?
Well, to start us off, the pilot shortage is here, and it's been making headlines. Network news channels have been carrying the story, as have dozens of print and online sources. Earlier this year, Republic Airways, a large U.S. regional carrier that flies on behalf of American and Delta, filed for bankruptcy protection. It blamed the filing, in part, on a dearth of qualified pilots. Other carriers have been canceling flights and mothballing aircraft. Yes, the shortage is real, some say. It's critical. However, to make clear which sectors of the airline industry we're talking about here, the first step in this discussion is to categorize properly First, we are looking specifically at the U.S. airline industry. Civilian pilots in the United States are responsible for securing their own FAA credentials and for logging hundreds of hours of flight time before applying at an airline. It's a long, slow, and very expensive process. Other countries often recruit pilots differently, with a growing reliance on so-called ab initio programs, whereby young candidates are chosen from scratch with no prior experience and are groomed from the ground up, so to speak, in a tightly controlled regimen that puts them in the cockpit of a jetliner very quickly. These programs are ultra-competitive, and there is no shortage of applicants. This is from an article dated March 1st, 2016, by Patrick Smith, whom we have had on our show. He's an aviation writer and author and has his website, www.askthepilot.com. George, thank you for moderating our roundtable discussion tonight. I certainly appreciate when I called you. You were so eager to do this. Why don't you take it from here? Because I've just about run out of text here. So if you would start us off in our discussion, and we'll just chat about the shortage, and I think you might have a question to open our conversation. George, it's all yours.
Thanks, Neil. As we know, this isn't the first pilot shortage we've experienced, although with the huge growth in commercial aviation throughout the world, and especially in the Pacific Rim region, this time around pretends to be the largest. If you recall, when the jet age got up to speed in the mid-60s, there was also another pilot shortage, and airlines like United hired pilots with minimum qualifications, but with one major difference. For the most part, there were three crew members in the cockpit, a captain, co-pilot, and flight engineer, and most of these minimally qualified pilots started their flying careers as flight engineers, meaning they could observe on a real-time basis what the pilots did. But today, flight engineers are, for the most part, a relic of a bygone aviation era, meaning that today's pilots start off in the co-pilot seat, which makes a tremendous difference. But let's talk about this more as we get into our discussions here. I'd like to welcome Dr. Michael Wiggins from Embry-Riddle, and of course Carlene Pettit, who Carlene's been on our show before. Dr. Wiggins, let me ask you: do you truly believe that there's a shortage right now of qualified airline pilots?
Well, there's a shortage of pilots going on right now, and by the way, please call me Mike George.
Okay.
There is a shortage of pilots that's starting, and it's going to grow, and it's going to continue to grow. It depends on what segment of the industry you look at. Right now, if you look at the major airlines, there's really not a shortage there yet, but some of them are getting nervous and starting to ramp up their hiring program. I kind of knew we had started a new era when Delta Airlines opened up a Facebook page for pilot recruiting. Most all the regional airlines have the same type of campaign going on social media looking for pilots that way. And just about every regional airline is working agreements with every college aviation program across the country trying to get pilots to go to them. It's going to be very, very competitive. And as a result, the starting pay for first officers in a regional airline in the last 2 years has essentially doubled. In some cases, it's starting to push in the between the salary and signing bonuses, pushing $60,000 a year first year pay for start. So, and
I'm sorry, go right ahead.
And I was just going to say the giant sucking sound in the industry right now is really happening at the flight instructor ranks. And that's got us concerned a little bit because if all the flight instructors are suddenly gone, that was your last hiring class, if you know what I mean. So it's starting, it's growing, and it's going to continue to get very interesting for the next 10 years or so.
Okay, Carlene, what do you think the cause behind this is? Is it the aging of the pilot group, the retirements coming up? Do you think that the retirement age is going to be raised once again?
No, I really think it's a combination of multiple things. We look at how many aircraft are being produced right now. We do have the retirement age going along with it. But also when they changed that 1,500-hour rule, that kind of really impacted the system a little bit. And I'm not so sure in a positive way, because while the general public, and we all know experience is great. You know, the more experience, the better we are. But if you look at this, say we've got 10, you know, say we've got 100 applicants and only 10 of them have 1,500 hours, and, you know, the other 90 of them have, say, 700 hours. Those 700-hour pilots could be the ones that have the aptitude, the ability, the talent, and may have gotten better experience than that 1,500, but we're kind of limiting ourselves to who we can select now because of this. And we know training's expensive. It's hard to get into it. You know, that's a huge investment for a parent of this young student, you know, child coming up and saying, Mom, I want to be a pilot. You know, this is what I want to do. And then they look at the cost of this training for a maybe career. And then the starting jobs, the pay is so low. I think that's probably eliminating a lot of people thinking it's just not a wise investment to put $250,000 into training. And that doesn't even get me my flight hours. And then I'm going to go get a job for, you know, $25,000, $30,000. How am I going to pay back my student loans? And so I think that might be a lot of, you know, keeping these students out. It's that expensive getting into it, that first-time early job, you know, where is this going to be? And I think there's a lot of fear also. What is this industry going to look like with next-gen and automation? And, you know, it's no denial that they're going to be trying to remove pilots out of the cockpit, you know, because we're so automated. I can see the day where they're going to take our four-person crew and go, nope, we only need three pilots, and the three-person crew, nope, you only need two, because we've got the automation and aircraft equipment so reliable. And hopefully they're not going to be utilizing this pilot shortage as kind of a means to the end of saying, oh, no, this is why we need to do this, because we have a pilot shortage and we can't get enough people to operate. But to say it's based on just one thing, it's growth. If you could say anything, it's just growth and then opportunity and economics for the kids coming in.
Well, you mentioned the cost of $250,000, $250,000. Is that for a four-year college degree along with the pilot licenses, say a commercial instrument, multi-engine, and flight instructor rating? Or is that just for the rating itself?
You know, and I think that's what at an ab initio school that you get your ratings, but that doesn't leave you with the hours that you need. You know, that just gets you your college degree and your ratings. You still don't have that 1,500 hours.
Well,
Mike,
yeah. Maybe you could jump in here. Isn't the 1,500 hour requirement that can be lowered? Is that not correct for certain military pilots and things of that nature?
That's correct. One thing that was written into the rule was that they would give credit for certain experiences. If they have military flight training, they're eligible for the restricted ATP, which is a new version of the rating in the U.S., at 750. If you graduate from a four-year degree that has 60 hours of certain approved courses via letter of authorization, you can get the restricted ATP at 1,000 hours, and if you go to a two-year school and get 30 approved hours of college credit, then you can get it at 1,250. So what we're seeing coming out of the colleges is that at the end of the commercial instrument multi-engine training, they've got 250 to 300 hours. They'll go work as a flight instructor for anywhere from a year to a year and a half until they hit the 1,000 hours, and at that point in time, the regionals are snagging them in. So,
okay, you mentioned the regionals, but not the majors, because I mean
the majors are going to pull from their regionals, and what we're seeing right now is depending on the regional and the timing of it. Some pilots that I know personally that have graduated within 2.5 to 4 years after graduating here being at a regional, have gone to a major. I've seen some make it to the majors in as little as 2 years after graduation, if they're in the right place at the right time, and do well on the interview process. So it's really fast-tracking to the majors at this point.
Well, you know, as you know, and Neil could chime in here, when Neil and I began flying, I know when I was hired by Eastern, I had, I think it was 3,200 hours, and that was really not that much, and I think Neil was probably pretty close to that figure. But so if I hear you correctly, what you're saying is that at 1,500 hours, a pilot will go to the regionals and then he'll flow through to a major, hopefully, after that. But that kind of leaves all the regionals in a bind, and that they're really the training grounds for the major airlines.
Well, one can look at that, but when you talk to the regionals, they don't want to view themselves as that way because they want to make sure that they're offering the same quality as the major airlines. So if you go talk to the people at the regionals, yeah, they understand they've got a serious problem, and they don't necessarily want to be the training ground because the higher turnover they have, the more costs they're going to incur, and the more it's going to squeeze their profit margins to try to serve the majors. So there's a lot of interesting dynamics going on. And what's interesting is what we're dealing with right now in terms of flight instructors graduating is a result of trying to sell the industry 5 years ago, because it takes about 5 years to take a high school graduate and get them ready to go to a regional with 1,000 hours in a minimum track. Some of the studies that one of my colleagues, Dr. Burns, did is he found that most of the people got interested in aviation at a very, very early age. And we're seeing that even with the students that we're dealing with, that they're feeling a passion they've had since they were preteens. And if we want to grow the next generation of pilots, if we were to go to a high school senior class today and convince them the industry is not going to see them for 5 years. And so when you look at the trends in high school enrollments, they're flat, in some cases dropping off. You look at new pilot starts, they're declining. And the number of commercial pilots and ATP is relatively stable. And so you start looking out in the future, and there's some cause to be concerned about whether or not this demand can be met.
Well, what if any effect would management's actions, past actions, have, in your opinion, with regard to the pay, the duty rigs, and the termination of the pilot pensions? Do you think did that discourage potential pilots from going into the field, or better yet, would it keep a pilot who's in the military from leaving to go to one of the majors?
I think right now what's going on in the military is there's a lot of pilots leaving the military going to the airlines. In fact, there's been several discussions about how to keep pilots in the military and keep them from going to civilian. So there's some interesting dynamics going on in the military. I know that I've talked to some people with the Air Force, and with a push towards their unmanned systems and remotely piloted vehicles, a pilot career in the Air Force may not be the same as it was 10 or 15 years ago. So there's a lot going on in that area as well. As far as the young kids today, they don't know what happened in the industry 10 to 15 years ago. They don't understand the change of the pensions, what was lost over the years, what the current dynamics are. All they're looking for is what they see in the future. And within the last 2 years, they see the pay go way up, and they think that's going to kind of happen for the future. So they're, you know, you got to look at it from their eyes right now, and then there's a lot of competing for other technologies out there that are competing for similar skills or similar interests of young kids that have equally rewarding careers. So that's another competition factor that's in there.
Well, I think that Carlene touched upon this when she first spoke, and maybe you could expand on it a little bit, Carlene, about what you perceive in the future. You know, right now, Every aircraft that is built for a two-man crew, a two-person crew, and yet you think that might go even lower in the future?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're working toward. I was out at a conference, and a Boeing engineer came in and said, don't worry, there'll be a time when pilots don't have jobs. We're designing airplanes to replace you. And I kind of laughed, and I said, I can do something my airplane can't do. I can land in a 40-knot crosswind. And he smiled, and he says, we're going to solve that problem. You know, and so here's the thing. They're working on it. They're working on it. It's all economics. I mean, sadly, our entire world is going to be automated at one point someday. Nobody's going to have actual jobs. And I know they're working on that direction, which is not unrealistic. I mean, and we look at it. Remember when they said when we were going from three-engine aircraft to two, and everybody said, all the pilots said, I'll never fly a two-engine aircraft over the ocean. The public won't feel safe. Nobody will do this. And here we are. That's what all we do today, you know. So times will change, and they are working that direction, which is I go out and talk to a lot of schools, and I think it's interesting the questions that the kids ask, and you can kind of tell where their minds are going. And really, it's a lot of financial, you know. What's the money going to be like that, you know, in the future? Will I have a job in the future? And you know, and actually my trying to convince the kids, or actually not convince them, but to encourage them to follow their passion. If you love to fly, you know, it's like, don't limit your job on something you think there's going to be a dollar sign attached to it, because the money won't ever make you happy. You have to love what you're doing. And all of us in aviation love aviation. We love to fly. And so that kind of is our driving motivation. But it is a question, you know, you think about putting this effort and this into this, am I going to have a job in the future? We don't know. And then look at the difference between the female pilots. And that's interesting in itself, because when you ask the young gals, do you want to be a pilot? They will say things like, no, I want to have a family. I'm going to be a flight attendant. And I don't think for some reason there's a disconnect that they realize that the flight attendants and the pilots are away from home the same amount of time. That we, if we're going to have a family, be a flight attendant, we could do it, you know, being a pilot too. So, but you know, it could just be the investment in time and money, and then trying to raise a family and having to step back because there's not options. There's things that these airlines could do, and even the commuters could do, that could entice future pilots. And if we have less than 3% of our workforce are women, maybe we should start looking at how to up that element, that side of it, and increase those numbers to help attack this pilot shortage.
Mike,
yeah, I
agree.
Do
you have any?
And one of the key things for the future is cracking the code with high school guidance counselors, so that and middle school guidance counselors, so that when they're talking to young people, 12, 13, 14 years old, juniors and seniors in high school, that pilots, technicians, are both considered viable careers for everybody. That's one of the key things that we've got to do. And like Carlene mentioned a while back, that there are some 750-hour pilots that would be absolutely outstanding starting off with an airline at that point in time, just because they have the aptitude and they're still in a learning mode to go do that. And we've done a couple of studies throughout the collegiate aviation community that pretty much echoes those facts. So I'm not too worried about smart young people getting in there and not doing well. I think they're going to do fine. My concern is twofold. One, finding those smart young people and encourage them to head towards aviation. And then secondly, trying to figure out ways to help them overcome the financial barriers to entry. Because, like you say, if you've got somebody that's got to shell out $250,000 to even start to begin to build the flight hours, or somebody with equal talent, equal aptitude, can go get another career, say, in computer science or computer engineering, and at the end have, you know, the same thing, but then can start in a job that starts off quite a bit, you know, way up there in the salary range, that's also who you're competing with. And they're smart kids. They're looking to make a buck. They're looking to make a life, and they're looking to move on. So that's some of the challenges as I see it, you know, from our end of the industry here.
Here's something else we could do, guys, that, you know, as far as making it cost effective, right in line with Dr. Wiggins was saying, is that what about glider flying? I mean, glider hours will, one for one, will port over to, you know, that's your total time. But that's something we can get the kids into when they're 14 years old. It's very cost effective. They could go to camps. There's a lot of avenues to get them interested in flying, and then they're going to learn some skills, some real good aerodynamic skills, which I'm afraid we're going to be losing with this automated world. We're not going to have the old stick and rudder pilots anymore. But so it'd be nice to get them into that route. And I'd kind of like to see, you know, we give credit for the ab initio schools and for the military. You know, what if we gave a two-for-one credit for an hour, you know, get credit for 2 hours for every hour of glider flight? That would encourage more cost effectiveness starting at the beginning. It would get them in hooked earlier, and it would give them something that they could actually get better credit for, and they would be good flight hours. I would rather have my newbie pilot have a background of glider flying than somebody who has 5,000 hours of pushing buttons, you know, and just putting autopilot on. So there's some things we can look at if we can shift our industry thinking a little bit.
Well, it's too bad that Steve Thompson is no longer with us, because I'm sure that he would like to jump into this conversation. As you know, Steve was the captain on the L-1011 that lost three engines that they almost had to put into Biscayne Bay. But we'll save that subject for another evening. But, Mike, what are your thoughts on do you think you'll ever see the day where the airlines will come to institutions like Embry-Riddle and say, you know, could you give us the best of your people and we'll pay to train them? Do you think that would ever happen?
I don't know. I mean, they're coming to us wanting them right now, and they're offering in some of the different programs we have, it varies from company to company, but they're offering little bits of financial advantage, not certainly enough to cover the cost of training, but you know, maybe supplement their living expenses a little bit. But what I see is, because that would have to fit into an individual company's model. But one of the things that I've been thinking about, and maybe we can get the message out, is if the major airlines as a whole could create a bank, and that bank could loan money to deserving young people who might not otherwise be able to have the financial wherewithal to go through the career or to go through the training necessary to get the career. But the difference between this loan and the current loans is that the payback would be graduated so that it mirrors the pilot's pay, so it starts off low enough. The payback is low enough so that whatever salary they've got, they still got a living wage and can start, you know, start their life as a pilot, start family, start moving forward, and then as their pay goes up, the payback on the loan tracks along with that so that it's equitable. So at the end of the period, they pay back the loan, whether it would have been straight line, but it kind of goes along with the pay. And I think if you were able to get something like that and possibly have some sort of a screening process, then you can find a lot of smart young people who want to do this but just would not otherwise be able to do it because of their financial or socioeconomic circumstances.
Yeah, well, I'd like to touch on that just a little bit. What are your feelings about, let's say, a 1,500-hour pilot going from a Piper Aztec into the right seat of an Airbus 320 versus having a certain amount of time as a flight engineer? Do you think that pilot is as qualified as the pilots of yesteryear were in the way they were brought up, in starting at the engineer panel for, say, a year and a half, and then moving to co-pilot and then up to captain? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, in about 2007, I was working with an airline And I was talking with one of their vice presidents, and we actually did a program where we took a handful of our students right at graduation and put them in to training for an A320-737 sized airplane, and they did fine. And they had a little bit of trouble ship going, you know, from a 3,000 pound airplane to a 140,000 pound airplane. But they all did fine, and there were absolutely no problems. It, you have to understand there's different skill sets. Yeah, there's a psychomotor skill set of flying, but there's also different skill sets with the management of the automation, the management of the system, the management of the situation. And very little of the current systems information that was known years ago is really needed today. Because the airplane takes care of it, and there's very little you can do from a cockpit beyond a certain point. So having seen it firsthand what they can do, I don't know that I have a huge concern about that. And all of these people that I'm talking about with are now flying captain and have been captain in this position for about 9 years now. So they've actually got more experience at that point than somebody went through a regional. So,
okay,
not
so
everybody can do it. Not everybody could do it, but the people with the right aptitude, I don't have a problem with it.
Okay, how do you make that selection? How do you say that pilot A has that aptitude versus pilot B who does not have that aptitude?
Well, it depends on how they got to that point in the selection process and what they bring into the equation. You have to have a screening process that's designed to look for that. There hasn't been a lot of studying done with this, but I would say that if you have to be careful about making comparisons about today's environment versus the environment 30 years ago or 20 years ago or even 15 years ago.
In what respects?
Dealing with the computers and the automation, we've got a generation of people right now to where the computers are absolutely they're embedded in their entire life from the time they have their first memory until now. They've always had a computer. Right now, we've got 4-, 5-, and 6-year-olds that know nothing. I mean, to them, having an iPad in their hand is second nature. Dealing with the computers and the automation and the information that it can manage and share. So the skill sets are changing. The ability to make decisions and have access to information is changing. Young people are changing. They're a lot more adept at some of this stuff than I'll ever be. And so I think that's one of the areas that we probably need to do a little bit more studying in right now. And as to how do you actually determine who does what?
Well, what
you know,
what,
George.
What,
George, may I put my 2 cents in here? This is Neil.
Sure, go right ahead.
Yeah, we've been talking about primarily training here in the United States. Do you have much concern about pilots that are flying into this country with training that? I'm not too familiar with what type of training, but I can see it demonstrated when a 777 lands at San Francisco and the pilots in that airplane does not know how to get to the runway. You know, that appears to be a lack of training skill that once the autopilot is turned off, can these people actually apply their skills as aviators? We call them aviators in our days. I don't know what they call them, computer aviators, I guess, today. But that concerns me. Should I be concerned if I take a trip over to Europe and I fly on one of these carriers that I question their skills? I'm going off the line here just a little bit, but...
That was going to
go ahead, Carlene.
Well, no, what we'll skip his next question because you're talking about the heart of my research for my dissertation, because this is not a foreign carrier issue. There is a ton of data out there that our pilots, that, you know, the Office of Inspector General came out in 2016 and said that our pilots lack hand flying skills, that we lack hand flying skills, that we can't monitor, and that we're confused. Okay, the data shows this. This is not just, you know, not just foreign carriers. This is what's happening, and it is because this automation and AQP training and cutting back training, because we no longer train to competency, we train to proficiency. And these young kids who can come in and push these buttons, they're awesome. I'd love to read you. We'll let George ask his question, and then I'm going to read you something that somebody sent me, a 27-year captain sent me, of what his concerns are with the future because of training. But we'll let George, go ahead and jump into your question you were going to ask.
No, that was my question, was that the pilots of today, as Mike described them, they might have the ability to understand how the computers work and how they function in the airplane. But my question was, are the basics there that you need when the computers fail or when something unexpected goes wrong?
This needle ball on airspeed.
Stick and runner.
Here's the funny thing is, when the new future, the airplanes are going to say needle ball and airspeed, and they're going to go, what? You know, you mean
right.
Airspeed? Do you mean the speed tape, or, you know, what trim? I mean, what do you mean trim? We don't trim our airplane. What is that? You know, it's like.
Well, Mike, I'd like to hear your comments on that question.
Well, I don't think there's any substituting for basic airmanship skills. And I know that, you know, at the beginning level of what we do here and what the other, you know, college programs and other do, is we're training to the same standards that we've always done as far as stick and rudder skills. I understand the concerns and have read a lot of the same research on the lack of automation. The lack of manual flying skills because of the overuse of automation in some people's minds. Whether it's overuse or not use, or people aren't doing this, or what, I haven't seen all of the data, but I know that some of the problems that they're having with the automation isn't necessarily limited to newer, younger pilots or less experienced. If you take the case of the Asiana 777 in San Francisco, I understand that that pilot had over, like, 10,000 hours, most of it in a 747 before he transitioned to this 777 on that. And he got either complacent or something like that when the FMS switched modes. And there was another senior captain sitting next to him, and then two other pilots sitting behind him with a lot of experience. So there's a lot of we can get over dependent on the automation. How an airline or how a pilot chooses to overcome that, I don't know that you can find any one single source or blame any one particular issue for that, because for the few instances where this comes out, how many instances are there where there are no problems?
Well, and, you know, here's the thing. Where there are no problems, you know, nobody takes into account, you know, we look at the mishaps, we look at the air, what we call pilot error. But there are every day hundreds of flights where pilots are making decisions based on their experience or some innate, you know, basically it is their innate experience and that gut feeling and something, and they make a decision that because of that decision never manifests into a problem. And we never get to see those, okay? So
right.
They're very real, and we need that. The problem with, we're in this place right now where we've got these older, experienced pilots who are now used to their what's built in their mind, their experience level is that stick and rudder. And we put them into an automated airplane, and we teach them how to push the buttons. Okay, and here's the buttons you need to push to fly this airplane. And they get comfortable with that knowledge. But just because you disengage automation doesn't take them back to their old school airplane. There is still elements of these computers are still, you know, managing the trim, and it's a point your airplane, and it's going to, the aircraft is going to figure out its best performance to get you there. So it is different. It's uncomfortable. And from what, during my interview process of interviewing Chuck Ehrman to try and, you know, fine tune my research, is basically is our pilots lack confidence. They don't understand the equipment. They lack confidence to disengage it because it gets comfortable pushing the button. Now, the young kids can push the buttons all day long. They don't, you know, but the problem is when these aircraft break, and they will break. You know, nothing lasts forever. Will this new generation who know how to do, you know, push the buttons and manage the system, which is the most efficient and actually the safest way to manage an automated aircraft in this complex environment we have because it's so saturated, it is the safest. But the question is, when the airplane breaks, will they be able to handle it? Will they have the skill set and the ability to do it? And the only way they're going to get that is in training. They're not going to get it on the line because we don't operate on the line like that. We operate with management on the line. We need to do it in training. And I can't, you know, it's like, if you can't tell, I'm very passionate about, we need to beef up our training a little bit to move away from this train to proficiency and get back to competency and get back to airman skills in that simulator environment. They're great tools if we use them properly.
Not going to disagree with you one bit.
Well, I think that, what do you think, Mike, is the contribution of this toward the pilot shortage that we began this discussion with? Do you think that the pilot shortage is going to be resolved as a result of this, or do you think it's going to be exacerbated by not only the automation, but the other problems that are inherent to the industry, the pass-through from the regionals into the majors, things like that? What's your gut feeling about it?
Well, I don't see a connection between the automation and the pilot shortage. What I do see is a continual increase in the aggregate retirements in the industry over the next 10 to 12 years. I see a declining entry-level pilot population as a contributing factor. I see the growth in aviation worldwide, which is going to be stacked on top of the retirements. And as far as it being just a U.S. problem, it's not. There are airlines in China right now offering over $300,000 a year starting pay for off-the-street Airbus captains. They're looking for expats, and the Chinese airlines are expected to hire 100 pilots a week for the next 20 years. That's what they're predicting. And so the growth in China is double what it's going to be in the U.S., okay? Europe and the U.S. are looking fairly close to the same, depending on what numbers you look at, and the actual numbers are just a guess. But if you look at the growth in the economies, they're talking about the middle income class in the world doubling. So India, China, the domestic growth there is going to go crazy. So now you've got people around the world competing for the pilot pool. And so will that entice somebody to leave here that maybe has some Airbus time or something to maybe go overseas rather than a domestic carrier? Who knows? It depends on what kind of lifestyle issues they want to put up with doing that. So there's a lot of growth going to happen in the next 20 years. So it's not just a U.S. problem, and it's not going to be tied to any one particular thing, but it's growth in the world population, growth in the traveling public, growth in other economies, the Asian market in particular is a big one, and Europe and sub-Saharan Africa and stuff.
Do you train many foreign pilots at Embry-Riddle?
That's what I
have about 15 to 16% of our students come in are international. Bulk of them are still domestic. We're getting some from the Middle East. It kind of rises and falls a little bit. Right now, there are some coming in from Taiwan, some coming in from Korea, and then we've got several coming up from Latin America. So, but about 15% of our population is, and there's a lot of places coming to the U.S. to learn how to train. But I was also talking with a group from China that they have their academic portion going on in China, but then they send them to a school in South Africa to train because of the airspace consideration. So it you know, like Bob Dylan said, these times they are a-changing. So it's...
That's for sure. Hey, Neil, that's basically all I have. If you want to jump in here with something else.
Well, it's, you know, I reflect back to my days. You and I came up in general aviation, not military. I had a little bit more time, mostly accumulated as an instructor. And I had to, at the time when we had workforce problems with flight engineers, and you can recall, I think it was Elwood Pete Casada that changed the rules and said that all pilots in a jet aircraft would have a all crew members on the flight deck in a jet aircraft would have pilot's license. And so my chance to get on with an airline I had to deal with becoming a flight engineer and come up through the ranks of a flight engineer. But George, I think you hit on it, and you and I have talked about it. That was the greatest training that I had, was to sit back in the rear seat, flight engineer seat, between the two geniuses there, and well, one genius and one God, but watch them fly an airplane and teaching me a lot about what, you know, eventually I would be doing. And so that was, to me, that was the greatest classroom, was in that back seat. Don't you agree, George?
Yes, I do. I had the largest plane I flew before I started with Eastern was a C-46, and I'd never flown a jet, and when I got there, I flew as an engineer for a year and a half, and yes, I agree 100% with what you're saying.
And it did. I saved a couple of captains, me and the first officer, when they strayed off the ILS on a 200, less than 200 and a half approach, and actually the co-pilot, I was about to, if he didn't, take over the controls from the back seat. So, but it really teaches you when you're actually in the airplane experiencing that and watching two men fly an airplane, hoping and knowing that one day you'd be doing it. And then eventually as a captain making your own decisions, and you mentioned Steve Thompson, I know that he never thought that he would be flying a 400,000-pound glider into trying to get to Miami International Airport, and what they did to manage to get back to the airport. It's just, you know, we used to say that they retired pilots when they got too old because they didn't know how to fly. And we had, I think I told you, George, that there was an airline pilot, I don't know whether it was Pan Am or TWA or which carrier it was, that was taking off out of Los Angeles on a four-engine aircraft, and it was his last day. That was his last flight. He was coming back home from L.A., and he had an engine failure on takeoff, and stopped the airplane at V1, and the critical engine speed, and managed to keep the airplane in the airport confines. Didn't lose anyone, and the airplane was intact when it stopped. But here, experience of a man at 60 years of age, nearing 60 years of age, Could a person younger than that handle the same situation as he did? I always err to the experienced person. And what a wonderful conversation we've had tonight. Mike, Dr. Wiggins, if you would, I prefer to call you that right now. How is Emory Riddle doing? Are you getting classes? Is there demand, more of a demand, less demand for pilot courses there now?
The demand is up a little bit this year. Right now, we've held even for the last 15 years or so, roughly at around 1,150 students enrolled in the program at any one given time. We enroll anywhere between 350 and 400 a semester. About 150 to 175 make it all the way to graduation. Some drop out. They realize it's not for them, or they have financial issues, so they'll switch to a different degree and get their flight training somewhere else. But what I'm seeing on the enrollment trends right now, last year and this year, it's starting to pick up a little bit. And I'm seeing uptakes in enrollments. Some of my colleagues at other universities are sharing the same results. So, it's starting to pick up. And there's more programs starting to come up across the country.
Are many in the courses there preferring to go into executive flying, professional pilots with companies, corporations? Do you have a course?
There are some. Yeah, I would say there's probably about maybe 5 to 10% that are choosing to do that. And what's interesting is about 3 months ago, we had some discussions with people from corporate aviation and the NBAA, they're starting to see a shortage of pilots also. And they're kind of concerned as to where their next ones are going to come from, because they have a whole different model of hiring in mind. For them, they paying attention to the primary client or who the executives are, is to them is just as important as flying the airplane. So,
yeah.
So it's a different mindset, a different skill set, but there's a lot interested in that. And the other thing that's competing for it is what's going on in the unmanned systems world. We've got a degree. Some of our graduates leave. They get hired on with an overseas government contractor starting in the mid-50s, and when they deploy, it goes up by a factor of 2.5. So they're meeting their financial needs that way.
Wow. Interesting. Carlene, you have any words to add to what we've talked about?
Well, hopefully all the young people are out there listening to this, that they will join this aviation world and just get out there and start flying. You know, I think a lot of it, the shift has been, we used to take our kids to the airport to watch airplanes take off, and I don't think you really do that anymore, you know. So it's sparking the little ones, taking them to museums or, you know, just putting it up to, you know, the what-if possibility and letting them know it's an option. So, but,
yeah.
That's the future. You know, interesting, I was watching something on the news this evening, and they were interviewing these kids on what they wanted to do with their careers. And I forget what the stats were, but they said a certain number of these kids, none of them, the jobs have not even been invented. They don't even exist of what all these kids are going to be doing in the future, which is kind of surprising to think that there's technology that in 15 years that these, in a little five-year-olds are going to be into a job that we don't know exists right now. That's how fast technology is growing, and it's our airplanes too. So,
well,
anyway, Mike, when I come down to Daytona this summer, I'm going to come and find you if you're around campus.
I'm second floor. You know where Dave Esser's office is?
I do. He is the chair of my committee.
Well, he is like three doors down from me.
Okay, I know how to find you now.
Dave and I have worked together for years.
Awesome.
Very good.
But yeah, looking forward to meeting you in person. I've read a lot of your stuff over the years, so.
Well, thank you. Thanks. Me too.
We hope that both of you will return when we have something that we want to talk about. As a matter of fact, our next two programs coming up. But before we get to those two programs, mechanics, you have a maintenance program there at Ember Riddle too, don't you?
Yes, Mike? We do. Yes, we do. And ours is we've got an associate's and a four-year degree, and we put roughly 250 or so in it at the time. It's pretty much maxed out. And if you look at the aggregate numbers, industry's going to hire more technicians than pilots.
Wow. Yeah. Chuck
and,
had
those technicians, once they get on with a major airline, within 5 to 6 years, will be into six-figure salaries.
I think you hit what I had. Chuck was going to read out of Lyft magazine, an excellent article about mechanics wanted, and the shortage is much more severe than the pilot shortage. From what I understand, according to that article.
Yep. And again, the key there is to getting high school guidance counselors to talk to people that it's a viable career that doesn't necessarily need a college degree.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. I have an A&P. What's that? It's an A&E, actually. Issued by the Civil Aeronautics Administration, CAA.
Yep. You're dating yourself, Neil.
Not many people have those licenses. Or actually, they're not called licenses. You know, I hear a lot of people talk about a pilot license, and I sometimes ask, where do I get one of those? And they say, well, I thought you were a pilot. I said, yes, but I don't have a pilot license. It's a pilot certificate.
You just hit one of my pet peeves.
There you go. And then I asked the next question. You know what the difference between a license and a certificate is? No. Anyone listening know the difference between a license and a certificate?
Probably $100,000.
No.
You buy a license, you earn a certificate.
I was going to say the certificate gives you the license to fly.
There you go. And you don't pay for that certificate ever. Once you receive the certificate, you've got a certificate. And you don't pay it. You just keep your physical and your recurrent training and so forth up. That certificate is earned, and it's good for, I guess, lifetime. But a license is good from time to time, and like our driver's license. We have to pay for that driver's license. You have to pay for a marriage license, too.
for a very, very long time.
Some pay dearly.
I remember standing in line for my marriage license, and right next to it was the guy in the fishing license, and he says, you're probably going to be better off getting this license.
Well, here's something that's kind of funny. I trapped animals. They're calling me now Trapper Neil. And I've trapped probably about 150 critters. They're called pests. And a pest is a raccoon, a possum, or a armadillo. And when they mess up my yard, I got to get rid of them. So I live in a subdivision that says you can't do that because you got to give it to a licensed trapper. So I looked it up on the Florida internet, on the Florida licenses, and it says, yes, you do need a license to trap animals. But anyone over 65 does not have to pay and does not have to get a license if you're over 65. Well, I went out and started trapping again. So... trapping animals. And it's kind of like
fishing. Did you read my comments?
Oh, golly.
Did you read
all
some
see
of my comments?
Yeah, I read them. Yeah. And somebody's sending me a recipe for possum stew, whatever.
I saw that.
But it's been great having you guys with us tonight. It's a wonderful discussion that we've had, and we've got some exciting programs coming up in the next week and the week after. Dorothy, can you remind me of what those programs will be?
Yes, I would also like to say that we have the Emory Riddle pilot shortage linked to the video that they had when they had that conference, that panelist. So that's on our website that can be seen, as well as some of the people that we had on the show tonight. We have George's two books listed, and we have Colleen has a list of five or six books on there, as well as yours, Neil, and there's plenty of interesting reading that you folks can do out there. So please go look at our website under the book reviews for all of that information. For next week's episode, we have passenger handling, and we're going to discuss the United and the American incidents that have been out in the media, as well as to listen to any of you folks out there to join in with the Eastern Airline days of any passenger incidents that you may have had.
I can do that.
And the following week, we're going to have pilot error, flight accidents, pilot error, or maintenance factors. And that's going to be quite an interesting episode that we're going to have. All of this information can be found on the homepage, the website. In addition to the fact, I wanted to mention to members that our mailings are reaching people in the United States, Mexico, Seattle, and all over. We also reach Montreal, Toronto, and Ottawa in Canada. We reach the Bahamas, Cambodia, Germany, Paris, France, England, Japan, and Nigeria. So we have a variety of people out there, members that are listening to our show. And I encourage everyone to go to the website and take a look at all the interesting facts and figures and readings that we have there. Neil, back to you.
Well, we have a board full of callers that I've had their microphones muted, and I've turned them all on, and I'm sorry that I didn't ask any questions from our listeners. So all the microphones are on now, and if you'd like to ask a question, please do so. We'd like to hear from you.
Neil, this is Manny.
Oh, Manny. Yes, go ahead, Manny.
Hey, Mike, you've got a beautiful campus at Embry-Riddle. I've enjoyed being there several times. My son went there. I've landed my airplane there a few times. You took a very nice care of me, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
My question is basically supply and demand, as everything else that happens in life. We were at Eastern, you know, we acquired 2020 Vision, your college grad, all that stuff. I wonder if any requirements might be loosened up a little bit. My son, for example, didn't finish up at Embry-Riddle because he had the opportunity to go fly. Now he's online trying to finish up online.
What was your question again?
Oh, if there's any insight as to the airlines, major airlines loosening up their requirements, like your Vision or college.
I
can address a little bit of that.
Okay.
As far as the Vision, the medical, as long as you're corrected to 2020, they're all of them are pretty much fine. But the interesting thing with some of the major airlines, they have their own little personal quirks. Like some airlines do not like online college. Some airlines want you to have your college within a very concise period of time, not over a five-year period. They won't even look at you. That's going to shift when it gets to supply and demand. When they start running out of applicants, and those things will change. So it really is airline specific. But it's odd because it's no longer the medical stuff. It's some pretty oddball things. Did you take 5 years to get your college degree when you should have done it in four type thing? Which is kind of unfortunate because there are a lot of really hardworking people who, you know, they were going to school, doing it on their own, working and making it work and, you know, achieved everything, which shows a lot of dedication and perseverance. and yet they're being eliminated from an opportunity at some airlines because of that. So.
No, and the example of my son, you know, he had the opportunity to build up his hours to get to 1,500, and I told him, hey, do it, because it's an opportunity you might not have later.
Yeah, you know, and those are the choices you gotta make, and really the hour thing is the key to get in, but I don't know. But he, how many hours does he have right now?
He's flying regionals now. He's 23.
Is he? Yeah, has he got an interview with any of the airlines yet? A major?
No, not yet. I want him to make left seat on the regional before he does that.
Well, here's the thing. I would have him apply. If he qualifies, I would have him apply.
I just retired from United, so I have a foot in the door at United with him.
Yeah, I would have him apply, because the thing about waiting, if he qualifies and he applies, then that's an opportunity. He may get in there, you know, 100,000 numbers above somebody else if he qualifies. If they, you know, that's a misconception. People think that if you get an interview and they turn you down, it's because it's something on your resume. You didn't have captain experience. You didn't have that. That's not the case. They won't bring you in for an interview unless they're going to hire you. So just by applying, if he can, the airlines are hiring people before, you know, some of them want that captain time, that PIC time, but if he can get in without having it, you know,
yeah, but he still,
I would tell him to go for it.
He still is working on his four-year degree.
Yeah.
Anyway,
you should give him, go on my website, give him my email. There's, we can at his age, I'll connect him to all the community that he's working with. There's a really good, strong pilot community out there, that people are out there helping each other. They all know the different ins, the current ins at each airline, what's going on. And he probably already has a good feel of it, I'm guessing, himself.
But, give us your website again, Carlene.
Yeah, it's carlenepettit.com, carlenepettit.com. And then if you want to get my email address, it's just carlene.pettit@gmail.com. So you just put a dot. But I have my website email address on the website, too.
Great website, too. Very good.
Yeah.
Any other callers? We've got our board full. Dottie, hello, Dottie. I see your error code 305. I know you won't talk, but that laugh.
By the way,
yeah.
I'm gonna say another thing too. This is Manny again. The Chinese, apparently, and not only just Chinese, but some European countries are buying up our flight schools down here in South Florida.
Oh my golly! Did you know that, Mike?
I did not know that the Chinese were buying them. I know that there's a couple of other universities moving around in different places. And I know that there are some schools in California and Arizona that cater to mostly foreign pilots. But I haven't heard any about in Florida itself.
Well, I happen to be involved with one now. I'm an aircraft broker now on the side, and there's a flight school, and the Chinese are looking into it, and they're looking to buy several flight schools.
Are there not enough qualified flight schools around the world, or is it just here in America?
Mike, didn't Lufthansa train their pilots over at the Prescott facility?
Their program's about half the size of ours, and their demographics are pretty close to the same as ours. To answer the question is, if I look at the total output of the collegiate aviation across the United States, I don't know if it can meet the overall demand on a sustained basis without some sort of growth. As far as around the world, I believe it's Oxford under the CAE banner has got like five or six major schools around, and they're probably the biggest civilian flight training organization outside of the academic world. They just do flight training. I know there's several schools popping up in Australia trying to feed the Southeast Asian market. And like I say, there are some from China and Korea that are actually going into South Africa for schools. So it's an ever changing environment, and there's a lot of interesting dynamics going on as to who's doing what.
Is there a case
Can I ask
where
a question, Neil? This is Chuck.
Yeah, Chuck, go ahead.
Do the pilots of the airlines for the out of this country still have to have the hours that ours have, or do they have a different hour schedule?
Actually, no, they don't. When the pilots, this pilot shortage was on the horizon, the U.S. went the direction that we did. Many of the other countries are going with what they call the multi-crew pilot's license, and that's actually what it's called. It's an ICAO thing, and that's where the cadets that are recruited come in, and they do flight training up through what we would call the probably the private instrument level. Then they move into heavy two-pilot simulator training, and from that point on, they are specifically trained to go right seat with one of the major airlines. It's being done in Europe. Lufthansa was one of the pioneers of this, and I believe they're using that model in the Asian market as well. So the rest of the world is doing it differently than us.
Well,
does it affect their ability to fly into this country?
Do what?
I mean, since we're having to adhere to this many hours, flight hours, and they don't have those flight hours, does it affect their ability to fly their aircraft into this country?
No, not really, because they're meeting ICAO standards, which we subscribe to.
Okay.
Is there the pilot shortage because we don't have enough pilots that are applying, or is it because those that are applying don't have the proper training?
It's there's not as many people moving into the industry as there has been in the past. And the other thing is it's a combination of the growth in the industry and the big bubble of retirements that's starting to go through.
Well, and there's another issue going on. I was just down at the Women in Aviation Conference where we have, 3,000 to 5,000 pilots looking for jobs. And I met probably a half dozen pilots from overseas, flying captain, that want to come work for a U.S. carrier. And so these guys have the experience of a captain, 10 to 20,000 flight hours, and they cannot get in our legacy carriers, and they're not going to step back and go to a commuter. But they have too
right.
much experience for the legacy, which is really a shame. And even some of the regional captains who have that 10 to 15,000 hour range, they're being turned down for the legacies because they have too much time. There's some concern, why they would be doing that. Sorry, guys, I'm looking through that lobby. I'm at the Detroit airport right now. there's some concern that, that's the high experience on the right seat, that these pilots are going to, maybe they think they're going to overthrow the authority of the captain. I don't know. Pretty much the pilots, we all respect the captain's experience, and no matter how many hours you have, if the captain's screwing up, hopefully you will have the courage to speak out. But, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot from the legacy carrier by not accepting these pilots because they're the ones that are going to be going over and flying for Norwegian Air. So,
right.
They have, what are they going to do?
Wow. What a discussion we've had today. We're just about to run out of time, but I'm going to let George Jen, since he's the moderator, sum up and give us his final thoughts.
Well,
can I ask one question?
there's really not much to add here.
Hang on a second, George. Just a minute, sure. George. I heard another voice there. You wanted to ask a question. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm Jake Burkett. I'm from Lakeland, Florida. And how do you tend to whittle out the bad regionals? And because, like, I read reviews and stuff. Like, you know, I'm almost done with my four-year degree. I'm almost done with all my ratings and everything, closing in on 1,000 hours. How do you whittle out the regionals that are not as good as other regionals? Because, like, I hear, like, a lot of people say, oh, you shouldn't go to that one. You should go to this one. And if I talk to somebody over there, they say, oh, no, you don't need to go to this one. You need to go to that one. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I did. Did you say your name is Jake?
Yes, ma'am. Uh-huh.
Yeah, Jake. Okay, you guys, is it okay if I give a little blip for a regional airline? I'll have to tell you, from what I've heard, and I've talked to numerous people, and I've met the staff at all these different conferences I go to, I'm not going to tell you who's not good, but I will tell you who I think is good, and is SkyWest. And SkyWest specifically because of their training. And everyone that I've heard, I mean, they get feedback from their pilots who leave and go to Legacy and call them up and say how superior their training was from what they're getting at the other side. And so for whatever, you know, I haven't seen the training program, but this is just what I've heard. So if I had a choice and I was starting over right now and I had to go, I would go there because you're going to get really good training and it's going to help you, you know, navigate the next level of your career when you do go to Legacy.
And, so, and how's like the pay and the benefits part of that? Because
probably like all of them, bad.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
You know, but here's the thing. You know, it's like go to Quality of Life. The people who work at SkyWest all really, really, really enjoy it. And I'm not sure if you were listening, you have my email. You can email me, and I will connect you with different people who are working for the various regionals. And I can kind of give you a more open and candid on what to watch out for out there, just because I've heard it. But I don't want to disparage any airlines. You know, it's like, but I will connect you with people who are actually working at these different, and they'll be able to tell you, you know, their perception.
Okay. What is your email?
It's carlene.pettit@gmail.com.
How do you spell your name?
K-A-R-L-E-N-E. Dot and then PETITT@gmail.com.
That PTE at what was it?
Two T's. Do you guys have it on your website?
Yeah, I was just going to say to you, we have the her website and I believe her email address on the website. So if you go to the EALradioshow.com website, you'll be sure to find it. It would be in the book review section.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Okay. Yeah. Any other comments before I let George sign off here with his thoughts?
Well, this is Mike. George, I just wanted to say it's been a pleasure to join you, and I've enjoyed the discussion.
Well, thank you so much, Mike, for being with us. And I'm not too far from you up here in St. Augustine. And hopefully I can get down south your way and stop in and say hello.
Well, you've got my email. Let me know when you're coming, and I'll give you the Cook's tour.
Okay, that sounds like a good one there. Very good.
Thank you so much, Mike,
again. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much,
Michael.
You're supposed to say, let me know when you're coming so I'll be out of town.
don't give away my secret.
And can I ask one more question? Is Linda Fuller online?
Yeah, you're online.
Linda Fuller.
Go right ahead. Go ahead
Fuller?
With your question. Yeah.
Not for Linda Fuller. Hey, Miss Linda. This is Jay.
Yeah.
So tell me, what was the most rewarding part of your job and the most difficult part of your job as a flight attendant?
What now?
I
want to tell Mike that I'm not calling him Mike. I'm calling him Dr.
Dr. Wiggins.
Yes.
Dr. Wiggins. Yeah, I'm not calling him Mike. I'm calling him Dr. Wiggins.
Okay.
Yeah.
Linda, I believe he wants to know what was the most rewarding thing that you could say about your career with Eastern Airlines as a flight attendant.
Oh, I spent, you know the rig but I just to move off because it drastically changed my life. And I've always been very grateful to Eastern Airlines, and it expanded my life, my education. I was from a small town in Indiana, and nothing wrong with that, but I had opportunity to get over my painful shyness and meet people, and I met my husband in the cockpit of Eastern Airline Electra, and I have 4 children, 11 grandchildren, and it is all going back to Eastern Airlines.
Thank you, Linda.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and now I'm meeting all these voices. I want to meet all these people with these wonderful voices.
Well, you not only Monday night can you meet all of these wonderful people, and Eastern people, and people like Dr. Wiggins. I'll call him Dr. Wiggins, and Carlene, Captain Carlene. Can I call you Captain? You were a captain with another airline, I believe. I'm not certain, but
I was. So you can go right ahead. I like the promotion.
Okay.
And I also like the promotion. I think I was called Doctor tonight too. I love it. That's like that.
Yeah, that's
proactively
good.
Thinking on this.
You're almost there, Carlene. Just call
there,
me Trapper Neil. I feel more comfortable as a as an animal trapper now. But we've had a good time tonight. We're just about out of time. And since Linda was a former flight attendant for Eastern Airlines, we're going to, would you like to do the arrival announcement? Remember now, Linda, that we are in a Curtiss Condor two-engine, mostly fabric airplane.
Right. Oh, I'd love to. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Atlanta Airport. Local time is 8:32, and the temperature is 72 degrees. For your safety and comfort, please remain seated until Captain Brown has brought the aircraft to a complete stop at the air terminal. Our ground service personnel will open the cabin door, and you will be assisted off the airplane. Please check with our baggage handlers near the plane for your luggage, and don't forget any personal belongings you may have brought on board with you. If you require deplaning assistance, please remain in your seat until all other passengers have deplaned. One of our crew members will then be pleased to assist you. Once inside the air terminal, one of our representatives will assist you. On behalf of Eastern Air Transport and the entire crew, thank you for joining us on this trip. And we look forward to seeing you on board again in the near future. On behalf of Captain Gene Brown, co-pilot J.B. Armstrong, and myself, Beulah Unruh, it has been our pleasure serving you. We hope you have enjoyed the flight on this newest of airplanes at Eastern Air Transport, and we hope to see you again.
Great landing, Pilot Brown, Dr. Wiggins, Carlene, George Jen, thanks so much for being with us tonight. We hope you will come back to be with us again. And as a producer, I want to say I did a mediocre job here at the board. You know, it's always fun when we talk about Eastern Airlines or the new Eastern Airlines and the place we work and worked and the stories we shared. We feel we've truly earned the title of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. And it's because of you, our callers, listeners, guests, hosts, and the sponsor, the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, REPA. Thanks so much. We look forward to our Eastern family and friends joining us again in May 8th as we file our flight plan to a destination yet to be determined. And until then, we all say good night, Eastern.
Good
night, we love you, Eastern.
Thank you, Eastern. Good night, Neil.
Good night, Dottie.
Good night, Dorothy.
That
good
would
night.
Be Trapper Neil.
We love you, Eastern.
Trapper Neil.
Good night. Sleep tight and pleasant dreams to you. Here's a wish and a prayer that every dream